ya lo hace, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
And we're back. Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Friday, February 1st, 2019. I'm Kevin Larame, joined by Dwayne Mullins, as always. And today on the show, James Grossi, a contributor to MLSsoccer.com, Waking the Reds, amongst other places. Did anything happen yesterday? I kind of have a feeling we missed something.
Yeah, I've been sort of staying off Twitter the last 24 hours, so you guys will have to catch me up on any developments.
James, stay off Twitter if you want to stay sane. I have a compulsive need to argue every bad point I see out there, and... Yeah, my fingers are sore, but okay, of course, we're going to talk about Sebastian Giovinco, no longer a Toronto FC player. He's playing on Mars, I believe, in the Martian League. Now he might as well be, for all we're ever going to see him again at that point, but that's my own sarcasm coming through. Were you surprised at all, James, or did you think that the writing was absolutely on the wall due to the shenanigans of the last week or so?
It was always one of those situations where, you know, the first indication we got of Seba sort of wanting this contract stuff to be taken care of was way back last year during the Champions League. And, you know, I always sort of wonder how much of a clash there is between that European mentality of contracts are rarely allowed to enter their final year versus here in North America. You know, it's a little bit more, maybe it's a little bit more accepted that contracts are allowed to dwindle down before you start having serious talks about what the next one is going to look like. And, you know, with the clock sort of ticking and Giovinco in the final year and that 6 month point where you could sign a pre-contract elsewhere sort of coming close, I think he was unhappy that it wasn't dealt with and he wanted a solution. You know, he brought it up at the Champions League and I talked to him about it midway through the year. And then we talked to him about it again at the end of season media and he's not a guy that likes having questions sort of lingering around. And so I think it just became too much of an issue and this other offer came up. And, you know, it's one of the unfortunate things about professional sports is that, you know, it is a business and sometimes decisions have to be made based on financial things rather than based on, you know, the sentimental part, the emotional parts of the game that we all love. And, you know, the writing was sort of on the wall. I don't think anybody really expected it to happen right now, let alone the club. You don't sort of make such a big change 2 or 3 weeks before your first game of the season. But, you know, sometimes those things are a little out of your control.
Considering how quickly it did go down, do you feel that TFC handled it well or could they have done things better to manage this message? Because certainly fans were not very happy yesterday.
Yeah, I think we sort of have to look at how this came about in the context of the way that the last few months have gone, or the last month in particular, just looking back, you know, when the rumors of Tim Bezbachenko going to Columbus first sort of surfaced, everyone was sort of taken aback by it, and nobody even really could believe it. And then a couple of days later, it's over and he's gone, and then a couple of days after that, Ali Curtis is in place. And, you know, I think the indications we had going into the offseason was that this was going to be a winter of very little change. It was going to be a very quiet period for Toronto, who were just basically looking to heal up and rest after what was a forgettable year in 2018, to put it lightly. And, you know, from the surprise of the Bez thing and then Curtis coming in, and Curtis was very adamant that you know, there wasn't anything immediate on his plate that needed to be dealt with. His mandate was to assess the situation over the next 3-4 months and see what he can do to add to what they're doing here. And between the Victor Vasquez deal coming up and Nick Hagelin going to Cincinnati and now Giovinco, it's been a way more active couple of weeks than I think anybody was really rationally anticipating. But again, that's sort of sometimes the rhythm of this business when the transfer window is open. And, you know, we've seen it across the league, whereas this league was often sort of quiet during these these silly seasons, it's starting to pick up and it's getting swept up in what the rest of the world experiences.
We're going to go back to the Giovinco side in a second, James. Of course, we'll talk about his famous agent now, infamous agent. But before we go there, I want to talk about the Ali Curtis or the Toronto FC side of this story, James. Ali Curtis is well known to have put together the Red Bulls team who won the Supporters' Shield and to have been able to have a great output of performance from a team not spending $50 million US a year on a roster. Is there any indication that the moves that Ali Curtis was forced to do over the last few weeks, but still he did them, that is any indication that there's a red tape going on at Toronto FC right now?
Yeah, you know, that's until we hear a little bit more from Ali and get to know what it is exactly that he's doing. It's really hard to say one way or another whether this fits with that pattern of sort of not necessarily being the highest spending club and sort of building from within, which is something that he did mention when he was introduced here in Toronto, how much he wants to be involved in TFC2 and creating that pathway from the academy to the reserve team up to the first team. But he was equally adamant that, you know, Toronto has been one of the biggest spenders in the league and that is their intention. You know, whether they are going to be the top spending team in the league, especially when you see the sort of shenanigans that Atlanta gets up to and some of the other sides are willing to do, that's always, you know, I don't know if that's a table that any club really wants to be at the top of forever. You know, you have to, the business side of the game sort of demands, not to mention the salary cap aspect, demands that you're smart with your money and you make wise financial decisions. And in terms of whether we can read into this, that Toronto has really taken a turn and the big DP days of the past are sort of gone, we'll have to sort of wait and see. You know, they've alluded to having one or two moves in the pipeline before the season starts, and they have a whole lot of TAM money lined up just with the way that this offseason has sort of played out. And so we'll sort of, I'm reserving my judgment on whether we should read more into this than necessarily the way that the rhythms of the game.
Now, Giovinco's gone. He's gone to Al Hilal in Saudi Arabia, like we talked about over the last couple of weeks. That's where the rumors were coming from, a team from Riyadh. And when you look at what Toronto did get in return, between $2 and $3 million for the transfer fee, were you surprised by that amount, James? And is it an amount to satisfy the fans, or should the fans be maybe a bit upset that it was only this short amount? If we compare them to the recent transfer of Almiron, I don't think it's fair. But if you compare it to an Alphonso Davies, that amount of money that they got for Giovinco was very, very low compared to other transfers we have seen this year. What do you think about the $2 to $3 million in transfer for Toronto FC?
Yeah, anytime a player is 32, if you're trying to compare it to either Almiron or Davies, I always view transfer fees as you're not necessarily paying for what the player has done in the past, but you're paying for their potential in the future. And so when you have a guy reaching his prime the way Almiron is, or you have a guy sort of just starting his career the way that Alphonso Davies is, those prices are necessarily going to be inflated. And you know, when Sebastian Giovinco signed a 5-year contract, I don't think TFC were envisioning getting anything off the back end of that other than whatever it was that he contributed on the field. And so, you know, you've seen people throwing around numbers like, oh, TFC should have got $20 million, TFC should have got this, should have got that. When you take into account the player was 32, he was 6 months away from being able to sign a pre-contract on a free transfer. You sort of take what you can get and you reinvest that back in the team. Now, I think I've seen some reports where Bill Manning said that the fee was higher than it was reported. But, you know, given the way that this league sort of manages the numbers, I don't think we're ever going to get an explicit figure.
I'll let Dwayne jump back in a second. But just before, James, when you look at the agent's work, when you look at Giovinco's agent's work on this one, some say he would be kind of shady. Let's just put it out there. The picture he put of the hotel 2 weeks ago that he said he was in Riyadh, it's a Google image picture that he just cropped to make it fit in his Instagram. But if you were a soccer player, if you were Giovinco, how happy would you be with your agent's work because, well, he created a storm, and the storm actually landed somewhere, almost by himself, the agent.
I hate to say it, but I think that's what agents get paid for these days. You know, it's it is not one of the sides of the sport that I love particularly, but the job of an agent is sometimes to grease the wheels on these things and to create a storm and to create a rush and to make business happen where maybe it wasn't necessarily going to happen. You know, I don't know quite enough about the ins and outs of how all these negotiations sort of start and who approaches who and just how much of a role an agent has versus a club when it comes to bringing a move like this about. But my general understanding is that, you know, as much as clubs do their own scouting and they approach people who they're interested in acquiring, there is a lot of leeway in there for agents to sort of make things happen for their players. And, you know, if I'm Sebastian and my goal is to maximize how much money I make over the course of my career, then this is exactly what I pay my agent to do. And, you know, you'd like to think that if he really wanted to stay in Toronto for the rest of his career, and that was what was best for him and his family, then they would have found some way to make that happen. So I read into the agent's machinations that he was doing what his client wanted. And, you know, as much as it can be a little bit frustrating and have some nefarious elements about it, I think that's just part of the game.
Let's talk about Josie now. Does this move make it more or less or the same likely that he's going to re-sign? Should he re-sign? And do you think that it's in TFC's best interest to actively and aggressively try to re-sign him?
Yeah, that's a good question because, you know, before TFC had their media day at the start of this year, TSN had a little interview with both Jovinko and Altidore, and you know that was sort of where this transfer talk sort of blew up, and between the two of them, Josie was the one who's actually sounded a little bit more resigned to the fact that he might be leaving Toronto. And whether that again is just sort of, you know, the player preparing himself or whether he actually has some inside information on what's going on, that's we can speculate about that, but until something happens, you know, that's all that it'll be. I think in terms of if you look towards the two of them and you compare and contrast, you know, Jovinko, he's 32. He's been healthy the last year. He's had his struggles in the past, and you never know at this point in someone's career quite how age is going to play a factor in their game. But he's a player that hasn't had significant injuries, whereas, you know, Josie has a couple of years on him. He's younger than Jovinko, but he has had those sort of significant injury issues. Has he, you know, we can leave aside the ankle one because I think that's a specific injury, but he's had nagging muscle injuries, and Toronto has done everything they can to sort of change the way that he trains and to help manage those. But it's always going to be a question mark with a player as they start to tick towards things. Now, I think what will be interesting to see is that Josie is a lot more, I think you could make the argument that with Sebastian Jovinko on the pitch, not that Toronto became predictable, but that there was an element of teams could prepare in a certain way to know that Jovinko was going to get on the ball an awful lot, and that was going to be a big part of how Toronto played. And it wasn't overwhelming, but it was something that teams knew was going to be coming towards them, whereas with a guy like Josie, I think you have a lot more flexibility to change the way that you're playing based on how you utilize him and who you use him with. And that flexibility is something that Greg Vanney's always sort of raved about. And so the question will be, the question will be very similar to what it's been with Jovinko, which is, can the two sort of agree on a number and on terms that work for both of them? I think if you look at Josie's output, he's definitely still a DP caliber player. Whether he will be in 2 years and 4 years, what sort of terms he wants, or if he, like Seba, is entering that phase in his career where he's got, you know, one more big contract, maybe two more big contracts in him, and does he want to maximize that versus sort of stay in a place that he's comfortable and he knows his surroundings. So it's always so hard to read into what these guys say in terms of what they really want. Everyone always says they love the club and they want to stay here, and Josie's made it. He's said in the past that he would love to retire here in Toronto and spend the rest of his career here. But, you know, sometimes talk is cheap when it comes to actually putting pen to paper.
Fair enough. Ives is reporting a Algerian midfielder by the name of Sofiane Henné, I believe is how you would say it. You know much about this guy, anything about this guy, and is that the type of DP replacement that's going to appease TFC fans?
I am not familiar. I've seen Ives's report, and I know Christian Christian Jack at TSN has weighed in on that too, saying I believe he said something along the lines of he's heard that, but that is not the big designated player replacement that he was referring to in an earlier tweet. And so I think if we look at how TFC is going to approach these next few weeks, there are reports out there that Terrence Boyd has come in. A lot of people are saying that he looks to be a Toussaint Ricketts sort of replacement, that sort of depth forward, see what you can get from a guy sort of thing. It's a little bit unfortunate for him that news came out on the same day that Jovinko was transferred, because I think a lot of people are going to be holding him up to a higher standard than maybe they necessarily should. But what I think we're going to see from Toronto is you can't really replace a guy like Jovinko like for like. There just aren't a lot of players in this world that bring you what he does, especially to MLS at this sort of stage. And so I think what we're more likely to see is Toronto change the way that they play. I was reading a piece, John Molinaro had a long chat with Greg Vanney, and Vanney pretty much said as much as that. You know, his team is constantly evolving, and that's the nature of it. When Victor Vasquez came in, they changed the way that they played a little bit. When Lucas Hansen was here at the end of last year, we sort of saw, or at least for that one specific last game against Atlanta, we sort of saw Toronto start using a winger, which is something that they really hadn't done a lot in the past. And that's something, too, that Vanney has talked a fair bit about. And so when you look at the sort of departures that we've seen this year, you lose a guy like Victor, who was very much that lock-picking, final ball kind of guy, and you lose a guy like Jovinko, who was very much an in-between being the final shot and being somebody that could be involved in the build-up. And so I definitely think you see Toronto address that attacking midfielder position, which makes this report of an Algerian coming in seem very legit, or at least, if not legit, at least something that would address some of the concerns. But I also think that if you're losing a guy like Seba and what he's meant to this team, you have to be looking for somebody who's going to come in and provide some consistent scoring, because that is really what Toronto is losing with Jovinko leaving. And you know, one of the things I've sort of had rumbling around in the back of my head is you know, one thing that always struck me speaking with opposing teams and opposing players was how much their game planning for Toronto revolved around Jovinko. You know, the first thing that they had to talk about when they began thinking about Toronto was how were they going to deal with Jovinko. And that not only occupies the team, but it also puts a little bit of fear into them. They know that if they make a mistake, they're going to get punished. And so I'm wondering if Toronto has become a less fearsome team with the departure of Jovinko, and I think whoever it is that they bring in needs to bring a little bit of that with them.
Right now, we don't know who they are going to bring in, and we can't assume there's going to be someone he brought in the short term, especially before the Champions League game in 18 days from now. But, James, when you look at the roster right now, when you look at the players in the lineup of Toronto FC during the training camp, which is started, who will benefit from the departure of Jovinko? Could the departure of Sebastian Jovinko benefit Canadian soccer as a whole, if you know what I'm saying?
Osorio. Yeah, I'm looking at the TFC.
I mentioned Osorio, that's why that's what I meant. But could Osorio be the big winner here?
I think Osorio will benefit from Seba not being there, as well as Victor not being there. You know, John spoke about how much of an influence it was to work with Victor, and how much of a mentor he's sort of been, just in terms of the way that he sees that game. And you know, watching John's career over the last 4 or 5 years, we've sort of seen a guy who was always tenacious and always had that skill, but sort of lacked the sort of, I'm going to say confidence, but I don't mean it in exactly in that way. He lacked that sort of assuredness, that coolness of mind that you sort of need to make the most of chances. And last year we really saw him mature and step into that. And so without two guys like Victor and Sebastian, who were, you know, as much as a team is a team, there are always sort of those guys who you feel you have to defer to sometimes, guys who you feel like, okay, maybe I have a shot here, maybe I can do something here, but Jovinko is right there. Should I just give him the ball? And so not having that sort of nudge towards deferring to guys of that stature could be something that we really see Osorio step up and really make the most of and just continue to see his development. But along with John, I sort of see a big chance here for a bunch of younger guys. You know, Ayo Akinola is a guy who's entering his second season in the league. And we saw little glimpses of him last year, but he's somebody that I think they really have high hopes for. And, you know, Jordan Hamilton, again, is a guy that only seems to get better and better at the USL level and just sort of lacks that ruthless consistency that you need to be a striker in a first team. And so I'm very curious to see how he does this year. And, you know, bringing Tsubasa Endo back, guys like Ryan Telfer, I think that's the sort of winger thing that I think losing, when you have two strikers like Jozy Altidore and Sebastian Jovinko, they are going to be on the pitch. It's really hard for a coach to make a tactical decision that says either one of your two DPs is not going to be in the starting lineup. And so him not being there this year does give Vanny a little bit more of that flexibility I was talking about to maybe tinker with how they play and maybe tinker with who's out there a little bit. And so I definitely think we'll see an evolution in the roles of some of these young Canadian guys going forward.
Let's talk about the coach a little bit. I think when Bezpachenko was there, Greg Vanney's job was really safe. Those two worked well together. He was his guy. Obviously, the success helped too. I'm wondering whether he has the same level of security now that Ellie Curtis is in charge and whether if TFC were to miss the playoffs again this year, because I do think that if you objectively look at this lineup, there's their playoff team. If he was to miss the playoffs again this year, is he in risk of losing his job?
Yeah, just to touch on what I expect from this team, I was just looking through all the rosters for all the MLS teams. It's something I sort of do monthly just to keep track of who's gone where and who's popped up where. And you know, I think it's easy to look at subtracting guys like Vasquez and Jovinko from your team and thinking that this team is definitely falling down in the Eastern Conference. And, you know, when you really look at teams and you get beyond that first 10 players, first 11 players, the starting side, there's not a lot of quality depth in this league. You know, most teams are probably looking at being 15 guys deep. And even with the departures that Toronto have had, they still line up to be one of the better sides in the Eastern Conference. And so I think even without knowing who they're bringing in as replacements, you still have to say that this is a team that should be competing at the top of the East and will be fighting for those playoff berths. And then, you know, what happens in the playoffs, especially with this new format coming out, it remains to be seen. But It's always so hard to tell how a new personality brought into a front office is going to sort of interact with the people that are already there. And, you know, we've seen this over the years with Toronto's past where you would bring in a coach and then you'd hire a general manager and then you'd hire a president. And that's just not the order that you're supposed to do those things in. People need to have their guys working below them so that they have that faith in them. And of course, Curtis coming in does sort of throw a wrinkle in the whole Bezpachenko bringing in Vanny and that partnership being solid. But I think what I would say for now is that when Ali Curtis spoke to us back at the start of January when he was announced, I was sort of struck by how important it was both for Ali and for Bill Manning that Greg Vanny was consulted and comfortable with who it was that they were bringing in at that general manager position. And, you know, it's sports. Things are always subject to change, especially based on results. But I don't think I'd ever really quite seen a coach's interest taken in into such a level of importance as we were given that indication at that press conference. And so You know, I think in Greg Vanney, Toronto has a very unique guy in terms of how much he has his fingerprints all over every single level at this club. And, you know, one of my favorite sort of pastimes or diversions when we're up at the training ground is to ask Greg about some random 15-year-old or 12-year-old in the academy whose name has come to my attention. And it is always striking how the fact that he's the first team manager and has all of his players to deal with and has everything else that's his responsibility and so many things on his plate and his own family and life to deal with, he will be able to give you a little synopsis of every player they have at that squad, even guys that are not particularly tied to it. I'll give you the example was when Canada was preparing for the CONCACAF U20 Championships last November, there were two players that were included on the roster that John Herdman put out that were not part of the squad. They were just being brought in for an extended training camp. And one was Jacob Schaffelberg and the other was a kid named Omar. I'm forgetting his last name at the moment. But, you know, as somebody who sort of keeps an eye on what TFC is doing at the academy, I'd never heard of either one of them. And Greg was able to give us a little synopsis on how they played and where they were going to school and when they were last with the team. And I don't think that's something you would give up easily, especially for a club that really wants to have that pathway from the 12-year-olds up to the first team be reinforced. And so I think it would take something absolutely monumental for us to be seeing any changes there in the near to short term.
Let's continue along that vein, James. You're mentioning TFC 2 earlier. You're mentioning the academy pathway right now. Obviously, this is a huge year, I think, for the academy pathway for TFC 2 because we've got the Canadian Premier League starting right now. That's going to change the dynamic of the Canadian development or the Toronto development area. What kind of changes do you think you'll see in the short and long term with Ali Curtis in charge?
Yeah, it's very early. It's very early to get into that, but I think we've seen. I think we've seen the first sort of, I don't want to be too definitive about any of this because with TFC 2 moving down to USL League 1, that along with the existence of the CPL has just sort of thrown such a, not a wrench in the works per se, but it's just sort of shaken up what was the current structure. You know, it was relatively clear before that, you know, you progress from the academy, you get up to TFC 3 and you're playing in League 1 Ontario, and then, you know, either you're going off to college or you're signing a USL deal and you're going to TFC 2. And, you know, between TFC leaving League 1 Ontario and going into the USSDA development academy system to TFC 2 moving to this new level in USL and then throwing in CPL, there are just a lot of moving pieces right now, and we're not quite sure how it's all going to sort of shake out. But there have been a couple of things that have come to the surface. You know, one of the things that happens with TFC 2 moving to USL League 1 is that for a lot of the older players, the guys that are, you know, in their 21, 22, do they really want to be playing at that level? And so we saw guys like Luca Uccello and Malik Johnson sort of decide to test their abilities elsewhere in the league, and Malik has gone down to Tampa Bay where he'll be playing with the Rowdies, and Luca has gone to Memphis where he'll be playing this year. And then we just saw the other day Rocco Romeo, a big defender, I think he's about 19 or 20, he's gone on loan to I think it's a Danish team or Norwegian team, a Scandinavian team either way, where TFC has a relationship, and so he's still under contract with the club, but they're going to give him a chance to test those waters and see how that furthers his development. And that idea of keeping guys with the club, but also being willing to loan them out to other places to give them a chance to further their development away from a place where they're really comfortable and where everything is sort of provided for them is something that I think we're going to see a little bit more of, especially for those guys that are in between the youth USL League One and MLS, there's a bit of a gap there in the structure in terms of how you take step to step to step. And I thought it was very interesting that Bill Manning mentioned that they were exploring the possibility of loaning some players out to Ottawa in terms of keeping guys at that USL level who might be a little bit too comfortable when it comes to playing in USL League One. And in terms of what Curtis is going to do when he really gets his feet under the situation, that will sort of really see. I was struck by how at his press conference he was very emphatic about how much he wanted to make the most of what it is that TFC are doing here. And Bill Manning said that was one of the things that attracted them about Ali, was his willingness to dig into those sort of less glamorous parts of a club and really be able to maximize what's happening there. And, you know, Red Bulls, you have to say they have one of the best academy systems, the way that they've done things there, and stocking the first team with those guys is something that Toronto would very much like to emulate. And, you know, with the addition of Noble Akello this year to the first team, we've sort of seen elements of that with TFC, but having somebody there who's sort of achieved that already to help foster that vibe and that aim here in Toronto can only be a good thing in the long run.
James, one last question before we wrap this interview today, and thank you for your time, by the way, on this cold and frigid February 1st. When we look at the Almiron transfer, enough about Toronto. Well, let's just touch quickly on Atlanta. And when you look at Miggy Almiron and his record transfer, him going to Newcastle of all places, what is your thought on his time with Atlanta, of course? But what is your thought on that total transfer and how his talents will be able to translate or not to Newcastle?
Yeah, I think as much as a lot of people, not to go back to Toronto, but as much of a lot of people have looked at Jovinko as a player who came in his prime and wasn't coming to MLS to retire, and I think we can read into the fact that he was sold and Toronto got a transfer fee as just sort of bolstering that whole idea. Almiron being a guy who came in from South America a little on the young side and put in his time and, you know, hopefully further developed his game and raised his profile before going on to Newcastle, is, I think, going to be seen as very much a model that a lot of clubs are going to aspire to replicate. And, you know, this is, as much as North American sports are used to having their own way and to doing things their own way, whether it's college or drafts or, you know, free agency or trades or whatever it is that we do here that the rest of the world doesn't do. Soccer is just not that game. It's a global sport, and finding your level in that. And, you know, I alluded earlier to the sort of transfer window madness that we've been seeing here. You got Luciano Acosta from DC, you know, possibly going to PSG. We got heads spinning, and we have teams that have games in 3 weeks. And that's just sort of, it's something that I think North American fans who aren't sort of fully engaged with how the rest of the world operates are sort of still trying to wrap their heads around. And so, you know, I can only see Almiron as being very much the model for what the league wants to do when it comes to bringing a player in, getting what you can from them over a couple of years and turning around and doing some tidy business. And, you know, I thought it was kind of funny that Almiron, a guy of his stature that did everything he did with Atlanta, was going to England and had some pundits sort of, you know, uncertain of what it was that he was bringing or whether he was worth the transfer fee. And,
well, those,
you know,
pundits,
one thing
James,
I know.
I'm just going to say those pundits, James, are not necessarily professional pundits, as they're not like, they're not even doing research. Like, just Google the man before you talk about him. Like, yeah, I never heard of him, so he must not be good because I've never heard of him. That famous personal bias because he doesn't know about the league.
And that's a poor excuse these days because, you know, maybe 20 years ago you don't have any way of getting some VHS tape of the guy, and so he does come in as a relative unknown, but, like, literally you type the 7 letters of his last name into any search engine and you'll be bombarded with chances to see what he can do. And, you know, how he'll adapt to Newcastle and how he'll adapt to the Premier League, I don't think there's any doubt that he has the talent and he has the energy. And one thing that I'm certain of is that the Newcastle faithful will absolutely love how dynamic and explosive of a player he is. And, you know, that's a club that's fallen on some tough times, but I know they have a rabid fan base that really loves an exciting player, and Almiron fits that bill to a T.
James Grossi, contributor of MLSsoccer.com, Waking the Reds and other places, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure, boys. Anytime.
And we'll be right back after this short break to talk about Almiron.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at @SoccerTodaySPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
We're back on Soccer Today. If you like what we do, if you like Dwayne and I's voice, you can always go to patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. $2 a month will give you access to the Two Solitude Soccer Podcast, a Canadian soccer-only show available for patrons only, 4 times a month, 1 time a week, and $2 a month will give you access to this exclusive show. This week, Rudy Schuler joined us, and we talked about, of course, the Canadian Premier League's announcement with Volkswagen. We've talked about the schedule a bit. We've talked about the MLS teams in Ottawa in Canada, so make sure you subscribe and take the deep dive and the pledge to listen to Canadian soccer. Dwayne, we're back on the show. Before we move to Almiron and I get your opinion on it, anything else you would like to add on the Jovinko saga?
Look, I mean, I said a lot, written form. I have an article on Canadian soccer news. You know, it's big news when I put down and start hitting the keyboard, right? So there's a lot of my voice out there already. I think that this is what I'm going to say. This is in contrast a little bit or to supplement what I've been saying to support the move. I do think that it was, considering all of the circumstances, considering that you have to, you know, he's looking for a 4-year extension here. He's looking for at least $7 million a year. We know that TFC has an internal budget for DPs that has been drastically reduced. That's been reported by several people. I know it from sources as well. So all of those things factored in. If you don't want to handicap yourself moving forward in terms of how you build this team and getting younger and getting more dynamic younger DPs in their prime, like Seba in 2015, 16, 17, back in there, you got to make this move. There's just no room for sentimentality in Major League Soccer, and that's the unfortunate reality of a salary cap league in a league where you're limited in the amount of DP slots that you have. That said, I'm going to miss it. I'm sad right now thinking that I'm never going to see that little Italian running around Bloomfield again. He was dynamic to watch for 4 years. You couldn't take your eyes off him. I mean, there were times when I could see people, screaming in the crowd, pass it to the little Italian, he'll do something. Every time a free kick got lined up, everyone stood up because legitimately there was a chance. I heard someone compare it to a free throw the other day. It was like he was taking free throws. Whoa. Sometimes when he was out at the top, right? Like it was – there were certain areas of that field where he had about a 50% hit rate from, and that's goes beyond wins and losses, just a pleasure of being in the stands. So it's a shame to lose that, and I get why fans are frustrated and sad that they're not going to get a proper chance to say goodbye to him. But in terms of the cold realities of the sport, it was the right move.
Yeah, no, it was. Financially speaking, over the next few years, it is the right move. And it's 2019, so it's not like you traded or transferred the 2015-2016 Seba Jovinko or 2017. You transferred the 2019 version of Sebastian Jovinko, yeah. which is a big difference there, too.
Well, that's what I said that very thing the other day, is that the fan kept going at me and at me and at me, and finally I just responded, is you're upset that the 2017, I used the 2017, 2016 was actually his peak year. The 2016 sub is not going to be in the lineup, but the sad reality was that he wasn't going to be anyway. Now, that said, all things being equal, I would have loved to find a way to keep him this year. And I do think that this creates a very complicated sort of situation for TFC in the short term, in particular for the CCL. But
all the hopes and the hype have died down a lot. And now people are like, okay, you're going to make it through Independiente, but what about the round after?
Yeah, well, it turns out, for sure, and I think that may be a good thing, because even with Javinko in the lineup, they probably weren't getting past that quarterfinals because it's going to be a Mexican team, and you know, it's just not as a dynamic team as it was a year ago. And this move in some ways will, you know, they're going to lose 10% of their fans in the short term. These were Javinko fans. These were guys that came in during the Javinko era that can't imagine getting rid of their best player. You know, they're having a temper tantrum in the corner bluntly right now, and that's fine. That they're fanning is what I should say more politely, and fans should fan. If they fans didn't fan, no one would listen to our podcast. So
whatever works for everyone. If you, yes, you want to exactly. be sad this about it, be sad. If you want to be optimistic about the future, be optimistic. And if you don't really care, well, you're allowed to not care too.
Yeah, precisely. But I think that, you know, I do think that this is a team with the amount of money they have to spend. And I think that this major, the move that Christian Jack, the Henny player, the Algerian, I do think he's coming in. That's a TAM player they've targeted that just happens to be swept into this. And everyone's assuming this is a DP replacement. I don't think he is. If in fact that transfer happens, and Ives has got some pretty damn good sources, so obviously there's something there. But I think that what Christian Jack implied, and keep in mind Christian Jack is technically an employee of the club, so he knows.
He's a partner of the club for sure, works for TSN, which is the broadcaster of TSC.
Yeah, they're implying that there's a major transfer coming in. And Bill Mann, in an interview on Primetime Sports here in Toronto yesterday, said that there would be a DP that, although wouldn't be as expensive as Seba, that would be coming in, that how he termed it was the informed football fans would know who he is. And informed football fans didn't really know who this Algerian fella is, right? You had to start doing the Google and watching the YouTube clips. You know, unless you watch the Russian Premier League or a Belgian expert, because he played in the Belgian League. He was actually the MVP of the Belgian League, just like Vasquez was. So a lot of people that, you know, are more even-headed yesterday were excited by that news, because Vasquez, obviously, we didn't know a lot about him when he came in, and he was a game changer and ultimately a key add to that piece of one MLS Cup. But the point being is that there's something coming, and it's probably going to come in the summer. That's what I'm saying here, is this will give TFC a little bit of flexibility. If the results don't go perfectly well in the early part of the season, everyone's just going to chalk it up to Seba being gone. They're going to be allowed a certain amount of leeway to get their bearing, and they could potentially add a big piece in the stretch. The other wild card to this that I think that no one's really talking about is now you have Josie. We're in North America. Josie's a North American player. He's okay with playing in a contract year because Josie's what? He's playing for a contract. And what do we always say about players in their contract year?
They're going to score about 20 goals.
Yeah. So I think this might be a good thing to have Josie trying to play for a contract if you want to win this year.
Unless he overextends himself and a muscle or two at the same time.
Well, always the question with Josie. You can't get around that one.
I know. It's like, yeah, I'm going to go all out and then pull the hammy.
Yeah, precisely. So the bottom line, and I said it to James in the interview, is that, look, does this hurt them? Yeah, a little bit. I would have pegged them as, honestly, I would have put them at second in the conference, based on the fact that New York's getting a little older and they have their own drama there. Obviously, NYCFC was struggled at the end last year. They've lost their talisman. Atlanta is still the top team, but they've lost a piece there, and there's some questions. They brought some guys in, but we don't know. So I thought TFC was right in there in the mix. Now that he's gone, I think TFC's more along the Columbus level right now, depending on who they add. But that's still a solid team that could potentially find itself playing deep into November next year if the pieces fall right.
Well, it can't be that deep because there's no games after November 10th.
Mid-November.
But early November, maybe. Let's continue quickly on Almiron. Almiron transferred to Tyneside, going to play for the Magpies at St. James Park for Newcastle. Miguel Almiron. Yeah, I used all my references. Miguel Almiron crossing the pond and starting his European adventure, his Euro trip.
It's obviously a big, big number, and this is really an influential move in terms of what it's going to mean for MLS front offices, and we're seeing it already in terms of even Acosta the next day. It didn't happen, but them flirting with the idea of selling him to PSG, right?
Well, isn't he in Paris right now? Like, I think he's in Europe, like, now.
He might be at the Eiffel Tower as a tourist, yeah.
Yeah, okay, the window closed yesterday, so we'll see, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it didn't happen. But it's even that idea was out there. It suggested to me that a couple of things. I mean, first off, you know, a lot of the MLS media will sort of play this the rest of the world is paying attention to this way. And there's a bit of that. But I think what's more important is the MLS is open for business now, and they're more willing to sell guys like this, even if they're going to hurt their short-term prospects. And I think you can tie the Jovinko move into that as well, is that in the past, MLS was reluctant to do that. They operated as a North American sports league, and they did not think in terms of sellers. Now that they've seen someone make $26 million, well, it started with Davies. They see a young kid that in the past maybe they hold on, make $20 million, and then they go and they get – this guy for 26, and it's like suddenly the owners are going, this is an interesting idea.
This makes my bottom line a bit more balanced and easier to get into the dark side and not the red side of my profit line.
Precisely. And I was on with Jason Davis yesterday on the United States of Soccer to talk about Jovinko, and we've got Endelmer on as well. And I said that precisely, is that one of the things when you look at TFC, this is related back to this again, the reasons they're dropping that DP internal budget is because, well, they can't justify the spend, right? They're too far in the red. They need to get closer to the black line. And the one way they can do that is by getting $3 or $4 million for Jovinko in the other end. Okay, well, then we can throw that back into the pot and use some of that to sign the next DP. So maybe they only had $2 million to spend, but now they've, you know, got $4 million back, so they can throw $3 million of that back into that. You know what I mean? So it all plays into that. It's all part of the factoring, because the reality is, if you want this league to push to the next level, you're either going to need a massive increase in TV revenue, which I don't think is coming. First off, TV is changing, as we know, right? Like, is the NFL and the NBA going to get massive TV deals moving forward the way that they're used to in the past? I'm not sure they will, because of the changing way that the people absorb that content.
They will. So the only properties on TV right now across the board that are actually making big contracts with broadcasters are sports entities right now, because sports is one of the only, if not the only, DVR proof viewing. Those and awards, right? Because you follow it on social media, you know right away what's going to happen. And if we look at just ESPN and the UFC, if we look at Fox with WWE, if you look at Fox and other properties, the prices of the properties go way through the roof, even though the viewership is going down, just because of the advertisers knowing that there's a certain amount of eyes that are going to come to the product because it's live sports. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's still a lot of battle for rights in the next coming future. But that's, I'm throwing back to you.
Yeah, perhaps. But in terms of soccer, we're talking in North America, you're talking about them nibbling at a little tiny, you know, nibbling at the ankles of this big giant, you know, TV contract deals that are out there, right? Like, they're, the money's just not coming in there. The point I'm making is that this is a way for them to raise their game. They're going to sell players. It's going to be an adjustment for fans of this league. It will be a huge adjustment, because a lot of the fans of this league are fans of the world of the sport, so they understand how it works. But there is a significant portion of MLS fan base that are just guys that go out, and I'm sure that in Toronto right now, people are going, well, why would you sell him for nothing? Like, that's how they view it, right? Well,
it's the exact opposite. He would have left for nothing. Now he left for something.
Yeah, and they said in the interview yesterday, the Manning interview, you know, not to point to other people's content, and specifically not to promote primetime sports, which doesn't need my help. But
no, they do not need our help at all.
Yes, but if you haven't listened to Primetime Sports, I can tell you right now, I remember it's at an hour 16 is when the interview starts. So you can flip to an hour 16 and you can hear Bill Manning in it. It is a worthwhile interview to listen to, because of just, he's very candid, and you can tell a lot between the lines in that interview too. First off, they mentioned Jovinko's salary in Saudi Arabia, and he literally did a spit take.
He laughed. Like, what? $11 million a year? That's insane.
Okay. Yeah. That wasn't where we were near, and it was very sincere. It's going to be an adjustment for people here to get used to this idea, but it's been coming, and it is how you get to the next level.
And there's a lot of players this offseason, right? Sorry, I was going to mention Kaku on top of it. So Kaku, Davies, Almiron, and there's about five other household name in MLS that Acosta was almost sold, but there's like five other household name in Major League Soccer that got transferred out for big money this offseason, which is almost a first, I believe.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's going to keep, it's going to slow down now because the European windows are mostly closed, although you do have a few more open till next Friday to the 4th. So that you'll see more movement still. And I think that's important. The 4th is another important date to keep in mind. That is when a lot of the windows, including the Russian window, if Henne is to come, that would be the date you'd be looking at there, would be the 4th, which this isn't next Friday.
It's Monday.
Next Monday. So the weekend has to do for that. So that's another big day. There's going to be more movement. And then after that, it'll slow down a bit too. In terms of, this has been a very TFC-centric show, so maybe it's time to move it all a little bit and talk about Vancouver.
Exactly. I wanted to quickly, to finish the show, talk about the Asian Cup. South Korea facing Qatar this morning in the final. What was the final score?
Japan.
Japan-Qatar. Did Qatar pull it off?
Yeah, 3-1. Qatar won with a VAR call at the end. You're going to love this. It's the first major decision. There was about 15 minutes left, and it was 2-1 for Qatar. And so, there was a very borderline handball call that was called through VAR. So this is the first VAR decision in a major continental final. That's going to get the headlines.
So you say Qatar, but I say Brazil. Brazil won the Asian Cup because there's about seven naturalized Brazilian with Qatar.
There's actually, I watched quite a bit of this tournament, and I'm going to be fair to the Qatarians as a team. They have done a lot of work at the youth level. They did win the Asian Under 20 Championship as well, that was an entirely Qataran team by its nature, right? So there is, I think, nine naturalized Qatarians on this squad. So that is something, including their big breakout, which is Almaliz Ali. He scored 10 goals in the tournament, which is a record, including an overhead kick to open the scoring today. This is a name that you're probably going to hear. Again, I'll say that again. Almaliz Ali is going to be a player you're going to hear about in the days ahead. He's going to draw attention probably of the big clubs because of his breakout. He's 23, and he came from the Sudan, and now they've naturalized him as a Qatarian. But this is the guy that was their star of the tournament, and they're champions, and it certainly is convenient for FIFA. I'm sure they're not unhappy that this happened. There's going to be whispers in terms of the fact that people are going to suggest that maybe this was manipulated. I watched enough of the tournament to say without a doubt that no, they're full measure for this. And part of that, I think, was the fact that the other big teams in this tournament, Japan, South Korea, Australia in particular, never looked particularly good. Japan was the finalist as well, but they were robotic almost, like they're tired and it's a weird timing, the Asian Cup coming this close after the World Cup.
And close after the Asian Games, too, which the Asian Games were just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, and there wasn't a lot of passion there. Iran had a good tournament as well. Some of the smaller nations rose up. You saw Thailand do pretty well, get to a quarterfinals for the first time. Uzbekistan, which is a team that has actually done fairly well in qualifying, they did pretty well as well. Trying to think other teams here. Iraq did decently. Like it was a fairly even tournament, more than Asian Cups usually are, where there's kind of a Gold Cups, Asian Cups usually. There's a march towards South Korea and Japan playing, and of course we have the upset here, and Qatar wins it full measure to them. The other part of it is it was held in the Middle East, not in Qatar, but in the UAE. Ran well, and I would expect that in 2022. There weren't any concerns about safety or anything like that, and I mean the concerns we have with the Middle East in a World Cup isn't about the couple weeks that it's happening. It's about how they get there.
Yeah, it's about how they let workers die.
Yeah, and that's not going to change. But in terms of them running a tournament, and it worked. It's in January, so nobody was dying on the field. Time zones are pretty decent. The final was at 9 a.m. So that's wake up breakfast of a World Cup final. I could see that happening. That's kind of fun. But
it's kind of better than we had at the Olympics last year. But yes.
Yes, exactly. No. Look, again, Qatar, that's your story. That's a high line. They got a breakout star in this. It was a fun little distraction for a couple months, but I'm not sure it was much more than that. They're both Qatar and Japan, the two finalists, are in the Copa America later this summer, which will we'll watch with interest as well. Although Kevin, I think you'll be busy still at that time. So yeah, I don't know whether we'll be having live shows this time.
We'll see. The other little interesting aspect is the new player for the Vancouver Whitecaps, the new DP, Hwang In-byom from South Korea, a young rising star. This could be the biggest acquisition in Whitecaps history. We'll see how it pans out on the field, but a lot of hype surrounding this player.
Yeah, and what I said this on Twitter this morning. It's kind of the Whitecaps news. They've signed 10 players or some crazy amount like that.
There's a new one this morning, the first Tunisian player ever to sign for Major League Soccer club now with Vancouver.
I'll stick with this. Predicting the Vancouver Whitecaps performance this year is a bit like predicting how the Canadian Premier League is going to happen this season. I just don't know. You can make some educated guesses, as we do with the Canadian Premier League, but really this is a whole lot of players together, and any bet you do on the Whitecaps is a bet on MDS. And he's done very well in the past, so don't bet against him. But this is a different level, and I'm not sure if you can piece together a bunch of, you know, Misfit Toys or Island of Misfit Toys, right? I don't know whether you can win an MLS Cup with an Island of Misfit Toys, but we'll see. If anyone can, it's MDS.
Yeah, because his American equivalent, in my mind, is Giovanni Savarese. And Savarese brought Portland in his first year all the way to MLS Cup. So who knows? Maybe the Vancouver Whitecaps will be facing Atlanta in MLS Cup on November 10th.
There you go. That would be something. I am curious to see how Atlanta does this year. And I'm not trying to be that guy, but...
But Martinez, you know, is not scoring 28 goals this year.
Like, yeah, and they've got to handle a CCL run, which they didn't have to last year.
And
there is
Martina,
a natural letdown winning a championship. There's a lot.
Like, just Tata left, so we'll see what De Bauer does instead.
Yeah, their fans are full of piss and vinegar right now, as they ought to be. They won the championship, but... I don't want to predict it necessarily. If I had to put a gun to my head and I had to predict the MLS Cup champion right now, I'm probably going to lean that way again. But don't think it's going to be as much of a cakewalk as people are suggesting, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, and I don't think this year I'm going to predict Kansas City either, because Kansas City's just not necessarily having...
Well, the Eichel Parra, yeah. We didn't even talk about Eichel Parra.
We talked more on the other side of it, how for Minnesota, it looks really good for Minnesota. They're having maybe their best off season, and kind of makes sense. They're going to open their new stadium. Their soft launch is over, and it's the hard launch, and they're getting the names and players and defenders that we knew they needed.
Fair enough. All right. On that note, Kevin, we tend to top these things off in an hour. We don't want to be the vocal minority and go 2.5 hours, the latest podcast.
That's good. I gotta
work.
we're only two here. If we're three or four, it's something, but only two talking for a long time? No. Need some saliva. As always, we thank James Grossi for his time. Today, you can follow James on social media at Grossi, so at GRAWSEE. You can follow Dwayne at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Larmy, and this show at Soccer Today SPN, live on Twitter at 11 a.m. daily. We'll be back Monday with more of the world of football with a soccer perspective. As always, thank you very much for your support. Every patrons out there, we really appreciate your support. It's because of your donations and your pledges and subscription that we're able to continue to do this on a daily basis. Make sure you go to patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. And as always, until Monday, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.